Okay, I will not hurry the question. You wanted to find out what happens when
the breath gets smaller and disappears. Your sensations in the body haven't gone yet. That's fine. It does mean that when you are watching the breath, you're not focusing totally on the breath. So the other sensations are still there. You've still got some body awareness. Now, what you really can do is to focus on the breath in the same way you focus on the movie, on the TV. And you should notice that when you are focusing on the movie, on the TV, if it's a very good movie, after a while, you cannot feel your body at all. You cannot feel your legs because you're right there in the movie and you can't hear any sounds. Like that Malaysian couple living in Perth, or watching a movie, and were at home. And once the movie was finished, they got up, one to go to the toilet, the other one to put a kettle on to go have a cup of tea. And when they got up from the sofa, they noticed many things were missing from their lounge room. True story, the burglar had been in their lounge room while they were watching the TV, and it must have been a great movie because they never heard the burglar when they were taking things right behind them. Now that's called samadhi. Oh, if only you could do that. So you're watching the breath, you don't know what's going on around you. Now you can do that with the movie, but see if you can do that with the breath. So the whole breath fills every moment of your consciousness. So much you can't feel the rest of the body. The body has vanished, it's gone, disappeared. Woohoo! Which means you don't have any aches in the body. No heat, no cold, no itches. The whole thing is gone, just like when you're watching a movie. So your breath got small and disappeared. Number one, it was probably not joyful enough. And number two, you know, you didn't really let go of the rest of the body. So seeing an echo of the whole body. And then all you got left is the breath. So by the time you're watching the breath, nothing else is left. And then the breath is so beautiful. And then when that goes, then you are flying. That will happen anyway, just this is the best way. Actually, when we first came, you said not to put our focus on the nose, stomach, etc. So I've been using the counting and foothold method, which can get me quite peaceful and calm. But then, you said to watch the breath from the beginning to end. What am I supposed to watch if I don't count? I only have a general sense of in and out breath. How can you observe the breath if not on the nose, stomach, etc.? Please give examples of how you watch the breath. I haven't got a clue whether the breath is going in the nose or the tummy. It's just going in somewhere. Who cares? All I know is it's going in. All I know is it's going out. That's all. Because my history as a meditator, I was taught first of all how to watch my breath at the tip of the nose. But I had hay fever. So during the summertime, I couldn't meditate. Why? Because my nose was blocked and it didn't go in through the nose. I thought, oh my goodness, that means 2 or 3 months of the year I can't meditate. And then I heard, no, you can watch your breath at the tummy. I thought, great, now I can now meditate any time of the year. But there, by this time I was a monk. And if you watch your tummy, this area over here, about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, when you haven't eaten all day, or not until early morning. Your stomach, your abdomen is so close to your stomach, you start to feel hungry. So watching the abdomen late in the evening is not a good idea, you start to feel hungry. So that didn't work either. And it was an insight, an understanding. The Buddha never said where to watch the breathing, he said watch the breathing. That's all. So, again, this is a very wonderful point. You know you're breathing in, you know you're breathing out, but that extra perception of where that's happening, you pay no attention to its location. All you know is that it's going in. You know it's going out. Where it's going in, where it's going out, you don't care. That's helpful because it means you're always breathing. So if you've got a blocked nose, if you've got a tummy ache or whatever, you're always breathing somewhere. So you know that it's going in, you know it's going out, and that's all you need to know. So you're unlimited in your perception. Just the knowledge of the in-breath or the out-breath, you're not really concerned about where on the body. And as far as seeing the whole breath, for those of you who have done some counting, you could try a type of counting which I learned when I was a student. As you're breathing in, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. One whole in-breath, count to 9. And as you breathe out, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So you can actually count with the breath. And that way you're actually starting to notice a lot of every in-breath and a lot of every out-breath. And if that 9 is too long, you do 6 or 3 or 4 or whatever. And keep it comfortable. And that way, because you're counting within one breath, you find it's very easy to focus on. It's a bit of work, though. And it's only just a little crutch. And after you've noticed, all of those 9 counts of one in-breath, 9 to 1 or 1 out-breath, then let go of the counting. So if you just notice the feelings, the sensations of an in-breath, the sensations of an out-breath, you don't focus on part of the body, you just know the perception of breath, that's all. And if you do that, the advantage is, because you're not focusing on the nose or the tummy or anywhere, your body gets let go of much earlier. So, let go of the body as soon as possible, especially when you get to my age or older than that. The body starts to ache. There's always something wrong with it. And that's why it's wonderful to drop the body as soon as you possibly can. In Northeast Thailand, they used to call an old man Poor Oi and an old woman Mer Oi. Poor means Mr., Mer means Mrs. And the reason they used to call them Poor Oi and Mer Oi is because every time they got up, they'd always say, Oi, Oi, Oi. And that was the nickname, that's true. So it was like, Mr. Groner and Mrs. Groner. Because, there's always aches and pains when you get older. So you can tell another person when they get up from bed and say, whoa. So if you're under 30, you do that, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. So only if people over 40 are allowed to groan when they get up from meditation. But we've found that happening. Because all these old monks have been sitting down a long time, they go, whoa. They have these little novices, 12 years of age. They just imitate the old monks. They go, whoa. You're only 12, for goodness sake. But they're just imitating. Anyway, next question. The sutras and new teacher Satipatthana is the basis and means to attain jhana. However, in mindfulness system, the yogi also requires to take up Satipatthana after jhana. Where in the sutras is this sequence method mentioned? Hasn't its function been fulfilled in jhana? Do we practice both before and after jhana? Yeah, there is one sutra, it is in the Satipatthana Samyutta. It says that you practice your Satipatthana, and once the mind gets a bit dull, you go into the jhanas, wind it up, give it some energy, and give it all the hindrances, and then you come out and do contemplation afterwards. That was the one which I was based on. I think it was the simile of the cook, was the particular Satipatthana, in Satipatthana Samyutta. But what it really means, it happens naturally anyway, and probably come into this later on. When you really do get into these jhanas, your mind is so powerful when you come out afterwards. And that's when you can really start to contemplate these things. I already mentioned this morning what mindfulness is, and powerful mindfulness, and superpower mindfulness. If you want to become enlightened, you can't have ordinary mindfulness. That's like trying to dig a hole with a spoon. If you really want to get enlightened. You're going to get powerful mindfulness. And you feel that. You've really got the power, the energy of the mind to, you know, really see deep things. It's just like getting one of these big earth-moving backhoes. It's just like you see up in the north of Western Australia. These huge machines. And just one scoop and a huge amount of earth comes out. They're so powerful. And that's the powerful mindfulness which you get after the deep meditations. Already that some of you are starting to get that as you get into the calm states. Imagine how powerful mindfulness can be when you've really got deep meditations. Really strong. And that's of course where you can find out the really deep insights. So yeah, you do it before, you do it afterwards. They all work together. That's why samatha vipassana. Samatha and vipassana. Sometimes sam is ahead up the mountain. Sometimes vi is ahead up the mountain. Sometimes metta, the dog, runs ahead. You know what dogs are like, they run ahead and they go behind and cock their leg up and pee on something or other. That's just what dogs do. Having a good time. And this is just, you know, samatha and vipassana. And anapanasati, the dog, too. And they go up the mountain. Sometimes one is ahead, and sometimes the other one takes over and leaves afterwards. They're all pretty much together. So that's, hopefully that answers that question. If it doesn't, you can ask another question tomorrow. Please, dear Ajahn, could you please remind people to respect no-well silence, including being on the phone, maybe smoking up on the hill. Especially actually that smoking is really prohibited because of the danger of bushfires. So absolutely no smoking. If anyone finds you smoking, he will put you under the fire pump and soak you all over. Because that smoking is bad for that. It's not just bad for that, it's really seriously dangerous. Because it's one tiny sort of drop of the cigarette and you've got a bushfire. And this time of the year, I mean, and that is, you know, maybe you may have seen bushfires in Tasmania, that destroys lives. So absolutely no smoking in this monastery. And in the Jhana Grove too. As far as being on the phone is concerned, some of you just have important things, but try and limit it, please. So you know, only have to ring up if it's really, 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 really important. You've already given one or two of you permission to go on the phone, that's fine. But you know, after you've been on the phone, just ask yourself, is it really necessary? A lot of times they know it isn't, it's just really just a bit restless. And as far as the no-well silence is concerned, as I say on every retreat, no bell silence means that we have no bells. So we don't give a bell in the morning to wake you up. We don't have a bell for... Actually, we do have a gong for bells. We don't have a bell saying you get up now and meditate. Bells to send you to bed again afterwards. That's what we call no bell silence. Because some of these retreats is like an army camp. You ring the bell, you've got to get up. Ring the bell, you've got to wash. Ring the bell, you've got to meditate. Ring the bell, you've got to get up from meditation to walk from meditation. Ring another bell, sit down again. Ring a bell for this, ring a bell for that. It just really drives you crazy. But this is no bell silence. So because we have no bells in this retreat, some of you may actually win the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, I told you you'd get some bad jokes today. That was my Nobel Peace Prize. Sure. Okay, this is because dead now. So, you can't stop other people from talking, because that's just, they've got mouths. So, if someone really is talking a lot, and then you can come and tell Dania, or the actor or me, and we do have some duct tape. And we put it around the mouth. You leave just a little hole there for a straw so that it can take your liquids. So that will shut them up. So that's the only way you can keep people quiet around here, duct tape. So just forget about it and remember, if they talk, don't you talk back. You just shh. That's all you can say. Just let them do what they need to do. But please be sensitive. Don't go talking in the dining room. Because there's other people there want to have a quiet cup of tea. And you're disturbing their peace. Don't go talking in the cottages. Because there's people who are trying to meditate in there. And imagine the bad karma. If you start talking and someone is just about to get into jhana, and because of you, and you're noisy, they slip out of the jhana. Oh, that's very, very, very bad karma. Imagine if somebody was on the mobile phone while the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree and disturbed him. There would be no Buddha. So please, be sensitive. This is a holy place. So please, develop the noble silence, the calmness, especially our moments. They don't need to speak. Anyway, but please, the smoking, that's really something else. Dear Ajahn, can Ajahn please suggest tricks to enable one to continue watching the breath when the body starts to ache and get disturbing? I did not want to move or change position. As I'm concerned, then I would have to start all over again from the beginning. So, you don't start all over from the beginning. If you're meditating, you go and ache or cough, and you just cough or you scratch or you move the body. You only go back a little way, maybe about a minute you go back. And then you can soon make up that very quickly. So after a couple of minutes you are back to where you started before you moved, and you can go much further because now you've got no aches or pains. So yes, you do lose ground when you move, but you don't lose that much. And you soon make up that lost ground and go much further. Which is why that nearly all good meditation teachers, they do move, do cough, do scratch. There's only a slight disturbance, you don't go back to square one. You just go a little bit back from where you were and you can soon catch up afterwards. So please, if the aching gets disturbing, move. Dear Ajahn, lots of people say Buddhist people are very selfish. Yes. As they only think of themselves. Yes. If everyone in the family goes on meditation, who is going to earn and find a living? Yes. Where the hell can you find time to do the other chores other than getting ordained? What do you mean getting ordained? I have to work my butt off with you guys. No, Buddhist people aren't selfish. You have a look at how much work they do. How much work I do. Didn't you see the monks this morning giving up to try and fix the leak so that you can have your showers? The monks did that for you. Who actually laid the floor here on which you're sitting? The monks did that up to, was it, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the day before we opened this place up. Buddhists are the opposite of being selfish. We work our butt off for other people. So, if you have a look actually what Buddhists do, look what Bianca's been doing, what Daniel's been doing. There's a couple of committee members here as well. They work really, really, really hard. You've got a few other volunteers who are working really, really hard at Dhammasala. See, this we work really, really hard. It's not selfish at all. And if you actually look for what we do, there's no such thing as selfish or the other. This is why, an example, in a relationship, in many relationships these days, there's one partner is selfish, and the other one is a sacrificer. They never think of themselves, they just think of the others. Both are stupid. That's why whenever I do marriage ceremonies, I look in the bride's eyes first of all, and I say,
From this moment on, you're a married woman. You must never think of yourself. And she always nods her head and smiles sweetly. Yes, I will not think of myself. Then I look at the guy, the groom, and say, now you're a married man. You must not think of yourself either. And he always hesitates before he nods. It's true, this is anecdotal, I've done this many times. Then, still looking at the guy, I said, now you're a married man. From this moment on, you must not think of your wife. You mustn't think of her anymore. And I look at the wife and say, and from this time on, you must not think of your husband. And that is when they all get confused. Which is great. Teaching through confusion is a great teaching tool because it means people are listening. They say, you know, what's the answer to this riddle? And the answer is, once you are married, you must never think of yourself, you must never think of your partner, you must only think of us. And they get it. It's us. It's not about thinking of your partner, then you get burnt out. It's not about being selfish and thinking about you. That's not a marriage. In a marriage, it's all about us. So, if there's a problem, whose problem is it? Our problem. It's not his problem. It's not that girl's problem. It's not my problem. It's our problem. That is Buddhism. Is that selfish? Is that sacrificing? Neither am I. It's all about us. We're in it together. So this retreat, it's not about me, it's not about you. It's about us. We're in this place together. In your cottage, it's not about you, it's not about your neighbours. It's about us. Not in our world. It's not about the Buddhists or the Christians or the Muslims or the atheists. It's not about us. And when you see that, you find out Buddhists aren't selfish. They're incredibly wise. They're not sort of sacrificing themselves for others. And for this third option, it's all about us, compassion. Dear Ajahn, is there any wrong meditation? Yes. Wrong meditation. What's good examples of wrong meditation? fantasy meditation. Thinking of all sexual fantasies. There was one. Don't think that we can't read your mind. There was this one man. He's a really nice man. He's a good friend of mine. But he couldn't stop thinking all these sexual fantasies. So he went to Ajahn Chah and said, look, you know, give me some tips and skillful means. So when I meditate, you know, I can meditate on the breath instead of, you know, sexual fantasies. They're very easy. He said, next time that all the lay people come to the monastery, you give the talk and tell them in detail all the things you've been thinking about while you meditate. That would have cured him, but he did have a guess to do it. And I'm sure the lay people would have loved that song. So that's wrong meditation, okay? But real wrong meditation is just using force, beating down on the mind. That is real wrong meditation, because it's coming from the wrong place. If you exert your will, all it does is you get bigger, stronger ego. Control freaks have got big egos and they just want to just more force. Whenever they get frustrated, they just try hard. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Stupid. So instead of that long meditation, do the soft meditation. Open it up and put things down. So that is the right meditation. You know it's the right meditation. It creates peace, it creates happiness. I know some people, I said this over in Korea, because some people go to some of these retreats, and when they come home from the retreats, they're worse than before they went.
they're angrier, more frustrated, more a pain in the ass to live with.
Why is that?
It's because they go to some of these retreats and sit through pain.
That doesn't matter what you experience, you're not going to take a rest. You're going to dominate your body and dominate your mind.
Those types of retreat where you use force and control, that just gets you even more to be a control freak, which means you get angry and more of a pain in the neck to leave it.
That is wrong meditation. If you want to make sure you know what right meditation and wrong meditation is, ask the person you live with when you go back home, am I a nicer person or am I a more difficult person? And if you're a more difficult person when you come home from retreat, you've been doing wrong meditation. If you're a much softer, more peaceful, kind person, then well done, that's good meditation. That is right meditation.
In brief, second noble truth meditation is wrong meditation. I want, I want, I want.
It is something.
Third noble truth meditation, just be content. Happy to be here.
What do you want anyway?
You've wanted so many things in your life. You're just trying to attain something. Go to school, pass an exam, try to get on in life. For goodness sake, just stop trying to attain things and be better than other people. Stop trying to improve yourself. You're good enough as you are.
Have you noticed the monks? Do we wear different colour robes, which tell us who's the senior and who's the most enlightened?
If you didn't know me, would you know who is the senior monk here, who's the senior nun, who's more enlightened?
Maybe it's Prasada, because her robes are much lighter.
So it's Venerable Gautama, she's very dark.
This must be, the robe you get when you attain the first jhana, a much brighter robe, and when you get the second jhana, it's much
lighter. But you don't do that, it's all the same. Notice we don't celebrate attainments or achievements.
We don't have all these certificates on the wall.
1962, Ajahn Mahal, speaking of 1964, once returned. 1982, certified levitator.
In doctor search, we have all that nonsense. We don't have that for monks, and nuns or meditators.
So, wrong meditation is trying to get something. Right meditation is letting go.
Very good question.
Ajahn, can anyone, if they want, see the Nimitta?
Yes, I guarantee everyone here will see the Nimitta one day.
I absolutely guarantee that.
If it's not while you're alive, when you're dead, floating out of the body, live that experience seeing the light.
That is exactly what you see in the Nimittas, when you're alive.
So, what happens when you die?
Five senses stop, body disappears, and you go floating towards the light.
Doesn't that sound similar?
Your five senses stopping in meditation, the body disappearing in meditation, and you see this beautiful light coming up in the mind?
Now you understand what that near-death experience is.
It is.
You just see an Nimitta.
So don't worry if you haven't seen an Nimitta yet.
You will when you're dead.
So another way of dealing with nimittas, we call this practicing how to die.
It's a wonderful thing.
You practice everything else in life. Cooking, you go to cooking classes. Marriage, you have marriage classes. You learn some dancing, tango. You go to tango dancing with Dania. And this is dying classes.
Without your plan.
So you can be certified, yes, now you know how to die.
You're going to do it anyway, you might as well get prepared for it. It's a very good thing to be able to do.
Anyway, so can anyone ever want to do everything? Yes.
Does it depend on the past karma? Is it easier if the person was in this path and has done in a previous life?
Of course. If you've done lots of meditation in your previous life, you've got lots and lots and lots of inclinations. So of course it's easier. But anyone can experience it in the place.
According to Buddha, where is life coming from if there is no creator? If there was a creator, where did the creator come from? So that is the biggest problem. Where did actually life come from? Life evolves, starting from even little blades of grass, according to Buddhism. And then consciousness, making that transition. You know that there are some plant life, which is just so close to animal life, you don't know the difference between them. But the felis, flytraps, or even other forms of life, are they plant, are they animal? There's not such a big divide in life. So maybe maybe the grass, which is grown in Jhana Grove because of its good karma, grow next to the stupa. Maybe that grass could actually get a big boost and maybe become an animal. And the animals, say the kangaroos over here, these are very, very holy kangaroos in this place. And because they're vegetarian, and they just eat grass, and they give lots of happiness and pleasure to you, maybe they become human beings in the next life. So this is actually where we come from, how life can evolve. So maybe that's where life is coming from. Or maybe it just comes round and round and round and round. I like the idea of circle. Because a circle has got no beginning and no end. Just like this universe. Now we're going to go in to astrophysics. Everybody should know that the age of this universe is about 14,000 million years since the Big Bang. And this universe has basically been expanding close to the speed of light. So we know the volume of this universe. It's a limited space, basically a sphere with diameter 14,000 million years or light years. So we can work out a volume, but there is no edge to the universe. Limited volume, but no edge. I'm sure just like me, when you were young, you thought, what happens if you keep traveling to the end of this universe? Do you come across a wall saying, no trespassers beyond this point? Or is there just razor wire, just like in the prisons? Or is there just an edge, a drop into the abyss? How can there be an edge? And the point is, there is no edge. It just goes round and round and round. Just like the symphony of an ant walking on a football. It goes round and round and round. Its area is limited, but it's got no edge to it. And that is this universe in another dimension, in three dimensions. It's curved. That was Einstein's great insight. So this universe in which we live, it's got a limited volume. But it's got no edge to it at all. So now let's go to time. Time escapes. It's only a certain amount of time. But it's got no edge to it. There is no beginning to time. No end to time. But it's only a certain duration. It's not infinite. Infinite. Not infinite. No edge. Can you get your head around that? A lot of times, problems such as this create a where does life come from? The solution is to change your perceptual framework. See it from a different angle, and it becomes quite clear. You are just seeing things in a one-eyed way. See it another way, and it's not a problem anymore. And this universe, I always love this bit of physics as well. This universe, in it, how can you get a universe out of nothing? It's a fundamental law of physics, I'm sure you've heard about it. The conservation of energy, or to be more accurate, mass energy. You can't create energy, you can't destroy it. You just change from one form to another. So if you can't create energy, where did all this energy come from? So this universe in which we sit right now, I'll tell you where it came from. Because in science, there is something called negative energy. Just like what you may remember from school, potential energy. To take this basket and to take it beyond the Earth's gravitational field into free space, you have to take up some of its energy. Any massive object in a gravitational field has a negative energy component. And there's many other force fields of our universe. So there is such a concept of negative energy. So what would it be like if the amount of positive energy, stuff in this universe, exactly balanced the amount of negative energy in this universe? And when I posed that to Professor David Blair at UWA in a talk, it was about 7 or 8 years ago, he turned around to me in public and said, "Wow, you are so up to date, Ajahn Brahm. Omega equals one." They always have these symbols for these things in science. And omega is the science, the physicist's ratio of negative and positive energy. So, the amount of energy in this universe, and mass energy, is zero. That's why it can come from nothing. And that's why it can go back to nothing. Why? Because there's nothing here. Just the balance of positive and negative energy in this universe in which we walk. Isn't that cool? Emptiness. It means you don't need a God. Nothing here. So, all the meaning of the universe, that would be nice. Nothing here. Well, it's much, much better. If there's some of this, it's a problem. When there's nothing, you've got nothing to worry about. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if someone is Buddhist but they have misunderstood about Buddha Dharma, should we correct them and explain it to them? Or should we be quiet? If we don't try explaining, we'll be creating bad karma. If we explain, we'll argue about the Buddha Dharma. Oh God, yes, sure you will. So many people know what Buddhism is, and they even argue with me. So shut up, just become enlightened. If you are fully enlightened, then okay, you can argue with other people about your understanding of the Dharma. And to prove it, to prove you're enlightened, I want to see you levitate at least 6 foot up into the air. If you can't levitate 6 foot up into the air, and you can't read my mind, then you still have something to learn about Buddha Dharma, so no use. You figure out yourself before you go teaching others. But they're really pain in the neck, aren't they, sometimes? They come and tell you that what you're doing wrong. I remember this old monk in Thailand once. And we were meditating, doing walking meditation. And he came up, he never meditated in his life. And he came up and told me, "This is not how you're supposed to do walking meditation. At least I'm doing it. You haven't meditated in your life." So sometimes the people are so arrogant, they think they know everything. But these are usually the people who don't do it. So anyway, you shut up, look after yourself. It's my job to tell people they don't understand. What a drama. "I followed your instruction, made peace with myself, and had the most beautiful experience meditating this morning." Exactly! I told you so. Exactly, it's what happens. I've been teaching this for years. "I followed your instructions. Made peace with myself, had the most beautiful experience meditating this morning." Get it? "I followed your instructions. Made peace with myself. And I had the most beautiful experience meditating this morning." Uh-oh. "By this afternoon." I should be honest without asking those questions. But this afternoon, as I had a battle with Mara, I was so restless and my thoughts were so meaningless and embarrassing sometimes. What am I doing wrong? Why can't the mind be still and peaceful always? It disturbs it. One of the problems is that once we get peaceful, we want the peace back again. And we forget where it comes from. We just want the results, we don't want the causes. If you can only remember the instructions, you make peace with yourself, you make peace with mom, make peace with the whole world. So just be happy just to have peace once, and if mom comes with all sorts of thoughts, make peace with those thoughts. Don't make war, and then the thoughts disappear. In other words, we forgot the instructions. Dear Ajahn, why do the nuns are not sitting by your side as the monks do? I believe nuns and monks are equals and should be sitting together without privilege.
It's because they're deaf.
It's true. When I was about the third stage, I'm going to sit over here so that we can if they have proper ears, they can be sitting on a Sunday.
They sent an email to sit there.
Sorry?
We have proof they sent an email to sit here.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so they are. So don't blame me. It's not my fault. But they're not that deaf, because she heard me say that. There's so much worse. What was that? If you could let us on a retreat take away only one or two things experience, what do you hope those things, lessons or teachings would be? If you're going to take away one or two things, you can take away the nuns. And build them a nice monastery. Because we need a nice monastery for the nuns. So take away one or two things, lessons. I would say don't take anything back with you from this retreat. Leave all your rubbish and your shit and your attachments here. So don't take anything back. Leave it all here. So when you go home, you are lighter, freer, emptier than when you came. So don't come here wanting to take things back. Dump in jhana grove. This is jhana grove dump. Jhana grove. Waste recycling, mental waste recycling. Leave all those mental stupidity here and we'll recycle. Venerable Ajahn, as a businessman, it is without doubt some, as businessman, it is without doubt sometimes deviate from Buddhist precepts. Is it hopeless for businessmen to learn Buddhism? Certainly they are much more difficult to try to retain stillness, isn't it? No! If you're a businessman or a businesswoman or a business monk, then if you use your Buddhist principles, you have an advantage over others. What's one of those stories? Julie's story. Julie, she lives over in Sydney. She, disciple of mine, started a fashion business. And all by herself, working from home, a really, really talented woman. She also had a little baby. I gave her the Buddhist name Surya, means son. Her real name is Holly, so I'm her monk. Really sweet little girl. When the girl was only about 3 years of age, her mum got a call from this big company in London. She'd been negotiating with this deal, which would take her business up to the next level. Really important to get this big break. And they said, please come to London, we're ready to sign the contract. So it was such a lucrative contract, she told her husband, can you please look after Holly? And she got on the next aircraft to Heathrow. When she landed, she only had time to shower, get changed, check into the hotel, shower, get changed, no rest, and go straight to the boardroom to see the CEO. When she got into the boardroom, the directors were there, not the CEO yet. And the director says, you have wasted your time. You may as well get on the next plane back to Sydney. The CEO is not going to sign any contract today. He's in a filthy mood, he's shouting and angry at everybody. he's not going to sign a contract. And Julie said, well, I'll come all this way, at least I'm going to see the guy. Suit yourself. So Julie, in the boardroom, sat down on the floor and meditated. But that's just what she did, she's a meditator. 5 or 10 minutes later, the CEO burst into the boardroom. Who the hell is that? What's she doing in my boardroom? Really shouting, really angry. And Julie just opened her eyes and got up and walked over to this guy glaring at her like some monster. And because she'd just come out of a peaceful meditation, she wasn't fazed at all by this guy's anger. Instead, she looked him in the eye and she said, the words just came out by themselves. She said to this really monstrous, angry, control-free boss from hell, you've got such beautiful blue eyes, like my baby Holly back in Sydney. That's what she said. And, you know, this CEO just didn't know what to answer. No one had said that to him before he was in a bad mood. And, you know, the whole brain started fusing. And then the next thing he said after pausing for 1 minute was smiling and said, really? And she had a contract signed within the next couple of minutes. And then, if she had a contract signed, he just wanted to go back and catch up on some sleep after a long flight. But the CEO went out of the room, the directors encircled her. And they would not let her go. Until she showed them how the hell she did that. To teach us how to do that. And so she had to spend the next hour teaching these people in the boardroom how to meditate. Because she just impressed these guys and girls how a little bit of meditation you can take an angry CEO and get your contract signed. We've got lots of stories like that. So, if you, what you learn here will give you a competitive edge. You'll be able to sort of look at CEOs who are really angry and get their contracts on. When the breath becomes beautiful, it fills and explodes into... This is good. This is a nice question. When the breath becomes beautiful, it fills and explodes into a bliss which is like dying in the most beautiful way. After time, I feel the energy in my brain shift and I'm shining like a flower in the sun. I am fixed effortlessly here for a while until another shift to rock-like stillness. I feel emptiness beyond description. There are no lights as I enter, so I'm not concerned. Shall I continue this way of practice? Or wait for lights which may never come? 5 years waiting. No, that's brilliant. So, that's, you know, sometimes it limits us and they'll become like a beautiful light, but what you say, yeah, that sounds like a charm to me. So, whoever did that, congratulations. But don't get jealous, everybody else. You've been able to watch one breath again, just these smart addicts doing these wonderful things. So that's excellent. So this, where did that walk out? But be careful. Don't want it again, otherwise you get so frustrated. Can a beautiful, breath be colourful swirl of light when the light expands the sensation of pressure pushing against the temple to air? It's normal, totally normal. The beautiful breath and the limiter are coming up. So yes, swirl of light, colourful, brilliant, just go for it. Any pressure against the temple air, they will just disappear as the body changes. Dear Ajahn, from the day one we were having a good retreat, a quality meditation time. I wonder what will happen when we go back home and return to our day to day. Oh, come on! Present moment awareness! It's not even the last day yet, you're already thinking ahead of what you're going to do when you go home. Who knows, maybe you won't go home. Maybe you'll die tomorrow on this retreat. So just let go. So don't even think about going back home until you get there. Isn't that crazy? Some of you were just really planning and all this work trying to get here. And just dreaming of coming on a retreat, and now you're on a retreat, not even halfway here, you're dreaming of going home again. We're always so far ahead of ourselves, and that's mostly our life. So please, learn on this retreat just to be here. And don't even think about tomorrow until it comes. One of my sayings, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. That's a very profound saying. Don't do today what you put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. So, you know, you don't have to think about tomorrow, or you don't have to think about the going back home and returning to say tomorrow. You don't have to do that, it's not happening today. So leave all of that stuff until much, 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 much later. Otherwise, you leave some of these people 2 or 3 days, you know, before they leave the retreat, they've already got their bags packed. But don't do that. Pack your bags the last minute. 10 or 15 minutes before you leave, then start packing. Instead of just being so far ahead of yourself. If you really want to plan, you might as well go and order your coffin now. You know, some people do that, they've already prepaid their funerals. Goodness gracious, that's really sort of control freak. So, I know we do not have a good influence as such here at China Grove. Each and everything is in the opposite way, starting with the husband and kids. I know, there you go. If I put time for meditation, surely all the house chores will get neglect. Yes, yes. Why do you have to have such a beautiful house? Remember, your house is not a museum. It's to live in. Even when you're doing the dishes in the kitchen, please, all you house-proud women or house-proud men, before you wash the dishes, please count how many dishes are clean. And if the clean ones outnumber the dirty ones, quit while you're ahead. You've got plenty to use, so don't keep cleaning them all up. Maybe I get in trouble with Bianca for this. But some of you just in polishing, polish and discharge, it's just crazy. So look, don't have to do all your housework. And if you really get fed up with housework, for goodness sake, sell your house and get a smaller one. People's houses are huge. And as soon as they've got a big house, what will they do? They're going to build a stupid extension. How many rooms can you live in one time? There's one. Go and see my cave. There's one simple room. I get my housework done. Actually, I never do any housework. I'm not there for me. But they get it done in some half an hour. That's what it means. So a small house is less housework. It's fewer rooms. Means you don't have to work so hard paying off the mortgage. And actually, I saw an article in the United States, because of the global financial crisis and many people having difficulty finding places to live, a company, you know, with the support of the local government, started manufacturing small houses. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. Instead of having these huge monstrosities in Australia. And now we've got the biggest houses in the world in Australia. And it's just ridiculous. So just small houses. Number one, they're very cheap to build because you don't use so much materials. And they're environmentally far, far more sensitive because they don't take so much metal and bricks and wood from nature. And best of all, they're so cheap. So you don't have to work your butt off for the rest of your life paying off the loan. And the best thing of all, so even better than cheap, because it's a small house, it means you're with your family all the time. You can't escape from them. Which means you learn how to love each other. The people you love the most, they're always there. And these big houses, the husband's in one side, wife's in her room, the kids are in their bedrooms, you don't know what the heck they're up to. You never see each other, because the houses are too big. So small houses, it's just stupid away for the future. The difficulty in Australia, the local governments will not allow it. The planning commission and building commission, no, you have to have this back space and that space and that space, everything had to be big. But now people are realizing big houses cause a lot of social problems, a lot of financial problems. There's a movement starting in the US, brilliant when I read this, small houses. Back to small again. What a wonderful thing. And then you get your housework done really quickly. So that's what we can do. So that way you can have much more time. I understand the sutras were written a couple of hundred years after the death of the Buddha, and before that were only transmitted by oral methods. Therefore, could you please tell us how can we be sure the sutras contain the real teachings from the Buddha? Aha, you should talk with Ajahn Sujatha and Ajahn Brahmani. Ajahn Sujatha is staying over here now. And Ajahn Brahmani and Ajahn Sujatha are writing this authenticity project. Which is, we've been talking about this for a long time. How authentic are the sutras? And there is very compelling evidence. Yeah, they were written down 200 years after the time of the Buddha, but they were written down as a pretty accurate record of what was actually said by the Buddha. So even though they're written down at that time, they were maintained in an oral tradition pretty accurately. And that's why there's a huge amount of information in this little book or pamphlet coming out from Ajahn Sujatha and Ajahn Brahmani. They're doing it right now. Very, very wise, well-informed monks, and very compelling evidence. So, and I really agree with them totally. That what we have is the sutras. There are some changes to the incidentals, like the place it happened, or the person who said it. But the actual teachings themselves, things like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Anapanasati, all that stuff, that is the original word of the Buddha. And it's very, very clear. So that will be coming out soon, full arguments. And it's coming from Bodhinyana Monastery. The center of the Buddhist world. The place where the best things happen. So, and you are here now. Maybe. Ajahn, Swamiji, how is it possible to live a life as a nun? Live a life of a nun as a lay. Then there will be Dharma in the park, as a lay person is allowed to go anywhere without restriction or precepts. Oh, you want Dharma in the park. There was this story of this, it was actually a Catholic priest. And when he was giving his sermons, no one would come because he was boring. He couldn't connect to people. So his bishop asked him to come in for a chat. He said, look, you know, you know your Christianity, but you don't know how real people live. So he said, I'm going to send you to a psychologist, a friend of mine, a good Catholic. So I went to see the psychologist, and the psychologist said, yeah, exactly what the bishop said. You need to get in touch with real people. So he said, next Friday, I want you to dress in a singlet, shorts and thongs, like they do in Australia, and go to a topless pub. Sit, get yourself a beer, and sit and get to know how real Australians think. I can't do that. I'm a Catholic priest. I can't go to such a place like that. Go, you have to. So this priest is really, really embarrassed and dressing up like a sort of an Aussie worker. And he sort of went into this bar, and all the barmaids were topless, and he was so embarrassed. And he sort of got himself a beer and sat on a corner table, hoping that no one would recognize him. He was a Catholic priest. And he became really embarrassed or something. He was one of the barmaids. Really pretty barmaid, you know, with big breasts. And just looking at him and smiling. And he just, go away. And then this topless barmaid got a beer herself and came and sat next to him. He said, go away, go away. Come on, the Patrick, don't you recognise me? Oh, no, you recognise you, Father Patrick. I'm Sister Mary from the convent. We go to the same psychologist. So now you know where all the topless barmaids come from. They're nuns from the convent. Trying to learn how real women think. No, it's not. No, I don't like that joke one time. There we go, okay. Okay, yeah.
So to live a life as a nun is a lay person. If you're a nun, you're a nun. If you're a lay person, you're a lay person. So if you go to the pub as a nun, you get to be drunk. I went to a pub once as a monk. This is what happened to me. It was out in Pinjarra, just south of here. I was invited to give a speech at the Rotary Club. Now Rotary Clubs, they always meet in pubs. But it's usually in a room, above the pub, around the back of the pub. And so it's usually no problem at all. I've been giving a talk in these Rotary Clubs many times, but this time in Pinjarra Club, the driver dropped me off, I went shopping or somewhere, so I was really stuck, and said, where's the room? He said, oh, it's in the back of the pub. But where's the back way in? There is no back way in. The only way to get to that room, you have to go right through the pub, past the bars. And, oh God, what am I going to do? Because I'm stuck there, the driver's gone, I'm supposed to give a talk there. So there's only one thing for it, head down, and go. That's what I did, head down. Broken, as fast as I could. So they came back. None of them are straight past to the room, see the room. And you know, of course, what happens? I was like, almost made it. So they grabbed me by the shoulder. Adam Brown, what are you thinking? And pulled me to the bar. And come on, I'm going. I never know issues, I'm having in the room. So there's a few times like that, I'm glad there's no one with a camera. Otherwise we're in a big trouble. So you can't go past the story about Jamiana Dunwall. This is a great story. He was travelling an aircraft from Adelaide back to Perth. And he said this was his explanation. Believe it if you want, don't believe it if you don't want to. He said the person sitting next to him, travelling on the aircraft, had a big phobia of flight. He said the only way this guy could actually survive the trip, it was only Adelaide to Perth, only 3 hours or 2 hours and a half hours, was by getting drunk. So he had whiskey was for free on his flight those days. So he had glass after glass of whiskey as he was sitting next to Adelaide talking to him. And he said, just as they were coming into land, the Perth airport, he had a glass in his hand when they hit turbulence. And of course you know where that full glass of whiskey went. All over Adelaide down his road. And so when he came out of the airport, he said, you smell like a distillery, what have you been doing in Adelaide? And no, I didn't drink anything, the guy sitting next to me spilled it on me. Things happen to you in life. So I hope you believe. But it is that. Then actually, India was the origin of Buddhism, but why there are not much Buddhists in India? Why do people worship Lord Shiva and Ganesh? Can you please explain? Even a lot of Buddhists worship Lord Vishnu. Is that a right thing to do? Of course not. You don't worship Lord Vishnu, you worship Lord Buddha for Buddhist. So, yes, Buddhism started in India. But for those of you who know your geology and the movement of the tectonic plates on the surface of this earth, you notice that many millions of years ago there was something called Gondwana Land, where Australia and India were actually joined together. And where they were joined was in Western Australia. True? The plains down there, that was under sea. The ridge of mountains in which you sit right now was joined with India. There must be some reason why Bodhinyana Monastery, Jayanagari, Dharmasaya are such powerful monasteries. Of course they were powerful, because in years gone past, India was just a kilometre over the and the great monks like Kassapa the Buddha, they would have walked over the land on which you now sit. This was part of India. That is why Buddhism is so strong, and why you get such great meditation in Jhana. There. must be something to this. Maybe Kashyapa the Buddha meditated right in the place where we built the hall of Janaka. Woo! Impossible. Anyway. Yeah, one of the reasons why I actually got kicked out of India was the Muslim invasion of the 12th and 13th century. They destroyed India with the Muslim invasion. And you don't want to be down on the Muslims, but they're culpable. When I meditate, this crazy music comes into my mind. No matter what direction I turn my mind, it comes again. How do I get rid of it? Please give me a solution. First of all, we call it. That might be some really good music, and we can use the royalties to build the Sarvastrava Nuns Monastery. So sometimes when music comes into your mind, crazy music, goes round and round and round and round, it's tough to get it out of your mind. So do no noble diet. So that actually blocks it out. It's called substitution, you know, by the Buddha. So you go up like a thought of repetitive music. You sort of substitute something else. And one of the best substitutions is Namo Buddhaya. Or do, you know, the chanting we do here. What if that's what the crazy music comes into your mind? Is that, you know, our chanting? So see if you can substitute into something else. And that's usually how you can do it. Can you please explain about vows? When you want to get a wish granted, you go to the temple and say you are going to give this much of money. Can you pray for me or do the needy rituals? Is there any truth in this? As well as the Sri Lankan Buddhists do this. What do you mean by Bodhi Puja and said, can we do this really work? I'm a Catholic. No, of course they don't. This is what the Buddha said. He said, suppose you have a pot, a clay pot of ghee. The ghee is like water. And you break that clay pot of oil over a pond of water. Then the clay will go down to the bottom, the oil will flow on top. And suppose a monk comes along and does some chanting with the resolution, oh, may the clay come to the top and the oil go to the bottom of the water. Would the monk be able to do that? And of course not, because oil floats and the clay goes to the bottom. He said, it's the same with all this chanting business. This is what the Buddha said. Now, you can't sort of just make things happen because of chanting. Now I know that people get very upset when I say that, because that basically cuts the income from all the monks. They get very upset. And fair enough, I said this over in Korea. Because the Korean monks, basically, they survive by chanting at funerals. And they asked me, does it work? And I said to everybody on TV, no, it doesn't work. But monks, you know, eventually do that just to be able to build their monasteries and pay their bills. While the Christians in Korea, everybody gets 10% of their income. And that's where they get their money, so they don't need to do that. So in Sri Lanka, please make sure you look after your monasteries. And then the monks won't need to do make money in those, you know, crazy ways. Okay, so you lay people, you're half the force. You know, not sort of looking after the monks, so they don't need to make money in those stupid ways. So they can get a livelihood, you know, just enough food in the temples. And especially, in Sri Lanka, okay, the Bhikkhuni monasteries, the nuns. The last I heard is lots and lots of women in Sri Lanka become Bhikkhunis, just like Prasanna. And it's very tough, this is reinstating the Bhikkhuni Sangha in Buddhism. And they're not getting support. You're still supporting the monks' monasteries and building these huge, huge monasteries for the monks. But you're neglecting the Bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. That's disgusting. So please look after the Bhikkhunis, look after the good monks, and then they won't have to do this all-night silly period ceremonies, which are silly, has nothing to do with Buddhism. It just makes the monks have sore throats. And you think that's making merit. It's not making merit. It's just total, I mean, get it from me, I don't mind getting into trouble, I'm well respected. It means that you're just destroying Buddhism.
to be looking after good things like meditation, keeping precepts, giving our donations to temples, not to monks, but to temples. So the temple can have enough food, support for the sangha. Okay, that's the same as finance, but in places like Korea. So, I was really feeling for the people in Korea, because the Buddhism is a very ancient religion there, but the Christianity is getting stronger in Korea because they get all this money coming into them. The money from the United States getting poured into these churches, and everyone who goes to the church gets 10% of the income, free tax. So, their people are actually much more generous than the Buddhists are. Which means that you don't have that corrupt way of looking for funds. Anyway, last question. I asked my mind repeated instructions to wake up at 5 o'clock. I woke up, it was 1:20, 1 a.m. Did you say 5 o'clock a.m. per time? So the first time we've been come from Sydney, I come from Sydney, 1 o'clock in the morning. That must be Sri Lanka. somebody in Sydney says Sri Lanka, and 5 o'clock in Sri Lanka. Anyway. Then I remembered that the time was a coffin story. Thank you, be well enough. So I woke up again at 5 a.m. Ah, very good. So when you woke up at 1:20, you remembered all the funny things which happened that day. This stupid coffin story which made you laugh, and that's wonderful. That's one of the reasons why you tell silly stories like coffin story. Because that makes it fun, it brings up a happy state of mind, which means you sleep well. If you sleep with negativity, like it sometimes happens, something went wrong today, you get really upset and angry, you have terrible sleep. If you say something funny, a stupid story, and then, okay, what's one of the worst jokes? This is one of the worst jokes, so you can go to sleep with a smile on your face. This was the two men standing on top of a cliff. And one of the men had a canary in a cage, a bucket guard in a cage. And the other guy had a parrot on his shoulder. And the cliff was about 300 foot, vertical drop. And they looked at each other, smiled, and the fellow with the bucket guard in the cage jumped off first. He just jumped off the cliff. I was hurling to his death. And the bucket guard knew that. And so the bucket guard started flapping its wings, because if he died, the bucket guard would be smashed too. And the bucket guard could very easily fly himself, but now he had to fly so hard to keep the guy up as well. So that bucket guard was flapping his wings so hard, he was panting. And it started to work, he was flapping so hard, the guy started slowing down. But still, it was really, really touch and go. So that bucket guard went for it. Well, he was flapping like hell. And the harder he flapped his wings, the slower the guy went. And so when he actually reached the ground, he just bent his legs to take the fall and stood up. He survived the fall. And the poor bucket guard was on his back, panting. Half dead, having managed to fly to keep the guy alive as well as himself. And the next guy was the guy with the power on his shoulder. He jumped off, but this time the parrot, he didn't start flapping his wings at all. So the guy took out a gun and shot the parrot dead. And an amazing thing happened. As soon as he shot the parrot dead, he started slowing down as well. When he hit the floor, he didn't even need to bend his legs. When he landed, it was like a feather landing, so light. And they looked at each other. And the guy with the parrot, still panting on his back, said, the budgie guy on his back, the other guy with the dead parrot. The guy with the budgie guy on his back said, this budgie jumping is good. Oh, but it's not as good as parachuting. Budgie jumping and parachuting. Anyway,
Okay, I missed one. I'll do that tomorrow because I told my joke. I don't want to spoil the effect of one of the most stupid parts I've ever had. Okay, so good night, everybody. That's the right question, and I'll answer it tomorrow. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.